start.
We're on page 667, and this is the last paragraph at the bottom.
We'll redo the paragraph we did last time.
Oh, okay. So the previous paragraph, not the last one. There are, roughly from this viewpoint, four main theories or categories of theory with their corresponding mental attitudes and ideas in accordance with four different conceptions of truths of existence. These we may call the supracosmic, the cosmic and terrestrial, the supraterrestrial or otherworldly, and the integral or synthetic or composite. The theories that try to reconcile the three factors, or any two of them, which the other views tend to isolate. In this last category would fall our view of our existence here as a becoming with the divine being for its origin and its object, a progressive manifestation, a spiritual evolution with the supracosmic for its source and support, the otherworldly for a condition and connecting link, and the cosmic and terrestrial for its field. And with human mind and life for its notice and turning point of release towards a higher and a highest perfection. Our regard then must be on the three first to see where they depart from the integralizing view of life and how far the truths they stand on fit into its structure. Shall we read one more? Should we read one more?
So, no, I think we just recap at this point because we ended with this paragraph, and this is a nice turning point of this chapter, because prior to this he has introduced, or he has actually recapped or summarized some of the things that he introduced before, which is how the whole structure, so to say, of being and becoming establishes itself. And that structure he summarizes in the paragraphs before this in terms of what is fundamental and what is derivative or derived. And these things, of course, we have about earlier because he has already developed them in previous chapters. First is the most fundamental root is the absolute. The absolute is that which is beyond any power to describe, indescribable in that sense, beyond any possibility of complete manifestation, because unmanifest in that sense, infinite, beyond all, you know, bounded infinities. Sri Aurobindo makes the distinction between bounded infinities and an absolute infinity. And, you know, even mathematically we can think about this difference. For example, the whole set of odd numbers or the whole set of even numbers is a bounded infinite. It's infinite. But at the same time, it is bounded by a certain law of generation, while the set of all possible numbers is more like an unbounded infinite. So the absolute is infinite in that absolute unbounded sense. Now we also have what one might call a certain kind of, you know, sort of transcendence of being itself. That is, it. When we think about what is being, we have to recognize it in terms of the experienceable, that which can lend itself to its own experience. And we think about experience as a property of human consciousness, but actually experience is a property of consciousness with a capital C. And ultimately, you may say that experience is a property of conscious being. Conscious being itself is a representation of something which is beyond experience. That is not that has not, that is beyond lending itself to its own experience. However, it is self-evident, that is, it has a fundamental notion of being something by itself, it's evident to itself. Knowledge is a kind of a derived process because it already implies a kind of reflection, a reflectivity, a kind of turning on oneself to know what one is. So consciousness arising out of that which is self-evident but beyond self-consciousness generates being, that is, as conscious being, and that is what we know as Achyudananda. That is the first presentation rather than representation of the Absolute. That presentation of the Absolute as Achyudananda in its roots is timeless and spaceless, is without any dimension, as it were, dimensionless. And out of that proceeds a certain kind of becoming, and that is the derived or derivative of being. And so these things he has already established. He has established that becoming itself has then a certain kind of a structure to it, a structure which has got a higher and a lower hemisphere, or one may say a lighter and a darker opposite polarities, but both of these are darker only in the sense of the latency of consciousness and lighter in the sense of the manifest unveiled property of consciousness. And that these two are the two infinities which are evolving towards one another as a progressive manifestation of the Absolute. So that is the structure, or scheme, or schema that Sri Aurobindo has established that links all these various powers. Now he comes, or consciousnesses. Now he comes to the point, the paragraph that was just read, the paragraph before that, is the key turning point of this chapter, because he says, if you look at the beginning of that paragraph, at this point we must take a step further and begin to regard the metaphysical truth we have so stated as a determinant not only of our thought and inner movements but of our life direction, a guide to a dynamic solution of our self-experience and world experience. And in doing this, he is actually manifesting or re-invoking the field of a Vedantic philosophy. Vedantic philosophy, ultimately, as Sri Aurobindo will tell you, the root of Indian philosophy is a constant coexistence between these two fields of darshana and yoga. That is, anything that one might know, anything that one might come to experience, or actually even speculate upon, even establish a mental scheme about, firstly, if there is a certain access to being through the property of human knowledge, it cannot restrict itself to just a speculation by the mind. But there has to be a deep contemplation and consideration of the intuitive basis of existence and experience. What do we experience? If we are going to talk about matter, what is the deepest intuition that we have of matter? If you're going to talk about life, what is the deepest intuition that we have of life, or of mind, or of spirit, or of soul? So this is the way in which Sri Aurobindo has established his schema. But then, as the Vedantic approach to philosophy goes, this kind even of an intuitive approach is a step towards true darshana, which is experience, knowledge by experience. Can we experience these things? Another place he says, no knowledge is truly known until it is experienceable. So that is the first step, and that relates the field of knowledge to the field of life. But it goes further in that, how can we come to that experience? Through a process of life called yoga. That process of life called yoga is the inseparable companion of the process of intuitive knowledge called darshana. So that is what he's talking about here, darshana and yoga, and he's stating it in Western terms because in the West, a split is made between these two kinds of things. There is no real field of yoga as such. Philosophy as metaphysics has split itself off from any possibility of really practice that brings us into experiential contact with these realities that we're talking about. And this is a very important point to consider, because Western philosophy, all the way going back to people like Socrates and Plato to some extent, and gradually more and more, particularly from Aristotle downward, has identified consciousness with mind and has made this property of knowledge as a kind of a knowledge of the logos, of the rationality of the universe through the use of mind. But we are starting from the very beginning with a different understanding of consciousness. And according to that, that more fundamental consciousness, of which mental consciousness is only one kind, one type, is our most fundamental reality, and that can arrive at a knowledge by identity with all these principles that we are considering now. And then that becomes the basis of the life orientation, the goal of life, the aim of life, as he is pointing out here in that paragraph. So it's important for us to understand what it is that these darshanas, that these various schemas of understanding reality hold for us, because that will also limit or circumscribe the aim of life or the aim of yoga for us. This is a very important point, because you know there is a certain notion that all roads lead to the same truth of yoga. All yogas lead to the same truth. And this may be true, but the fact is that there is a certain kind of limitation of aspiration that is related to darshana. If we believe that these beliefs are not just mental beliefs, they also come, this is the key term, adhikara comes over here, that they are related to psychic belief, that this is the reality, then in a sense that particular belief as a psychic belief is what circumscribes the possibility of experience as well. That is why he's making this point here and bringing up these four theories of existence and going to consider them, because he's trying to say that these exist as separate theories by themselves. Why? Because of the nature of mind and because of the nature of soul as a kind of a mental within, as operating within the mind. The psychic being is also operating inside of a mental consciousness. That's why part of the whole process of the integral yoga is to take the psychic being, bring it forward, make it govern the life, mind, and body, and then raise it out of its conditioning by mind into overmind, identity with overmind, and finally to find the soul in its supramental status. So here, this is partly the reason why Sri Aurobindo is considering these theories of existence, because we are, or even our psychic existence is circumscribed by these kinds of approaches to reality. And we can very well get stuck in one of them. So what are these? That's what he's laying out here as the supracosmic, the cosmic and terrestrial. Just 1 minute. I think Punita is trying to call me. Between darshana and yoga, and at this point he's laying down the four major theories of existence, and these he sort of delineates as the supracosmic, the cosmic and terrestrial, the supraterrestrial or otherworldly, and the integral or synthetic or composite. Now, Suprachosmic is something that he has repeatedly brought to our attention. This relates to the absolute, but when he's talking about it as a theory of existence, this is a darshana. Basically, what he's saying is that we may hold that reality is only the supracosmic. This is the theory of existence. Not that there is an absolute which is the fundamental and source or origin of all things, the only thing there is. Okay, but that this is the description of reality. Now, second one, the cosmic and terrestrial, in this particular definition of the term, is actually what one might call the material universe. In other words, what astronomers study, okay, that is our astrophysicists study, that is our Earth and all the other worlds and the stellar bodies and the constellations and space and time and the space-time continuum and all that kind of thing. The third one, the supraterrestrial or otherworldly, is the notion of worlds that are parts of the universe that are non-material, otherworldly in that sense, that do not belong to the material universe, okay, that are planes of consciousness, for example, that compose what one might call a universe, an invisible universe. And finally, the fourth one, which he calls, again, three terms there, the integral or synthetic or composite. And of course, each one of these terms means something slightly different, as you can imagine. The composite is, you know, you may think about a mixture, okay, or a amalgam, okay, where there are a variety of elements that have been kneaded together, that are in relationship with each other, but that retain their separateness. A synthesis is the formation of a new entity in which the compositions or the constituents have been actually subsumed. They have been brought into relationship and, you know, covered over with a new entity, something new. Integral relates to something that is, you know, that is a unit to start with, that not only that is not just synthesized, but that already exists as a unit with constituents inside it. Okay, so this is the difference between the three. Now, we may say from a certain point of view that there are ways by which these three kinds of, you know, unities may point to the same unity, the integral. And they may point to the same unity because they may be approaches dependent upon our own limitation. Approached at from the mind, we may try to synthesize the various kinds of realities or theories of reality that we encounter. But approached at from the super mind, we might view these realities as one, that is, as an integral reality, as already containing everything else, as a single super mind, one mind in that sense. Okay, so these are the various ways in which he has laid out these theories of existence. And in describing the fourth, the last category, he has also given in a nutshell how that fits his schema. And I read that part because it's such a short way he has just stated it all. In this last category would fall our view of existence here as a becoming with the divine being for its origin and its object, a progressive manifestation, a spiritual evolution with the supracosmic for its source and support, the otherworldly for a condition and connecting link, and the cosmic and terrestrial for its field, and with human mind and life for its nodus and turning point of release towards a higher and a highest perfection. Our regard then must be on the first three, on three first, to see where they depart from the integralizing view of life and how far the truths they stand on fit into its structure.
Devashishita, I have a question about the one of the initial part of your explanation.
Yes.
So, is experience synonymous with becoming? You were saying that experience is a property of the being, but I was thinking experience is more in the field of, it seemed to me more like another way of saying becoming.
No, experience, yeah, you may say experience is in the field of becoming, but experience from, I mean, when we are talking about being from the field of becoming, as we are beings, if we can conceive of being with a capital B, what is it that defines being to us, what, or conscious being to us? Conscious being is definable as that which can be experienced. And ultimately, that which can be experienced can experience itself. So, in terms of being, you may say, in terms of becoming, you may say, experience of being, or being as the experienceable, is where being and becoming come together. In other words, becoming knows being at the point where being is experienceable. You see, so the very fact that, you know, there is a being, we may talk about a being, means that there is what, something which cannot be even described as being, that the absolute, that which is self-evident to itself, but that cannot even call itself, you know, come into its own awareness of itself as something, becomes something where it is experienceable. It is the first stage of a becoming, of a being becoming, you may say, as a hyphenated entity.
Okay. So there is first
being. Satchidananda is a presentation of being, a presentation of the absolute, but even in being present, in presenting itself, the absolute becomes to an extent, see? So, but at the same time, it doesn't become in our sense of becoming. There's a very, very interesting passage where Sri Aurobindo is talking about events, you know, in the chapter on Brahman, Ishvara, Purusha, he's talking about events, and he's saying that for us, events occur in time and they have duration. But as we go higher, we can actually enter into a spaceless and timeless realm where even there events occur. But events over there have a totally different meaning or totally different reality than what we think of as events. They are eternal events. They don't happen in a continuity of time. You see, so this is a kind of, you know, being becoming, you know, being. The absolute experiencing itself as being, presenting itself as being, is a becoming, but not a becoming in time as we know it, but a becoming which is timeless.
Okay.
It's quite heavy, you know, quite profound, but you know that is the level at which we can think about being as experienceable and relating to becoming.
Okay. Yeah, it's very nice, fascinating even to just hear and read about it. So Devashishita, one more clarification. Could you expand a little more on knowledge and experience and where they? It seems to me that at some point knowledge and experience are the same. And could you talk about where the division occurs and at what point are they integrated?
Yeah, ultimately, when we are talking about knowledge, and Upanishad is talking about knowledge as vidya, or Sri Aurobindo is translating knowledge as vidya, what he's talking about is knowledge by experience, or knowledge by identity, ultimately, which goes even beyond experience. It's self-evident knowledge. But knowledge is a kind of exteriorization of experience. In other words, that is why it is self-reflective. Knowledge itself is a property of consciousness which is objectifying itself. What I experience, it can be, you know, we are all experiencing life at all times, but do we therefore cognize about life? Do we bring it into the field of our knowledge? We do that when we employ our consciousness to actually reflect upon life. You see, that self-reflexive property of experience through consciousness is knowledge. Now, ultimately, that property becomes fused with a kind of pure experience, which is simultaneously knowing and experiencing, conscious knowledge by identity.
Okay.
This last part where he puts everything in perspective, where he says one is the field and the other is the nodus, it is a very heavy sentence.
Yes.
I hope it's he's going to expand it. I hope he's going to expand on, or perhaps he has expanded. Okay.
Oh, of course. I mean, this the way Sri Aurobindo works, I mean, up until this point of this particular paragraph, at this point we must take a step further, etc., he has been summarizing what has gone before. And then from this point that we are talking, this particular paragraph we covered, he is in a sense summarizing what is going to come after. So all that he said in this little paragraph is what he's going to expand in the rest of the chapter and in later chapters.
Great.
Meera, would you like to read?
Yes, I can read. In the supracosmic view of things, the supreme reality is alone entirely real. A certain illusoriness, a sense of the vanity of cosmic existence and individual being, is a characteristic turn of this seeing of things. But it is not essential, not an indispensable adjunct to its main thought principle. In the extreme forms of its world visions, human existence has no real meaning. It is a mistake of the soul or a delirium of the will to live, an error or ignorance which somehow overcast the absolute reality. The only true truth is the supra-cosmic, or in any case, the absolute. The para-brahman is the origin and goal of all existence. All else is an interlude without any abiding significance. If so, it would follow that the one thing to be done, the one wise and needful way of our being, is to get away from all living, whether terrestrial or celestial. As soon as our inner evolution or some hidden law of the spirit makes that possible. True, the illusion is real to itself. The vanity pretends to be full of purpose. Its laws and facts, they are only facts and not truths. Empirical and not real realities are binding on us so long as we rest in the error. But from any standpoint of real knowledge, in any view of the true truth of things, all this self-delusion would seem to be little better than the laws of a cosmic madhouse. So long as we are mad and have to remain in the madhouse, we are perforce subject to its rules, and we must make, according to our temperament, the best or the worst of them. But always our proper aim is to get cured of our insanity and depart into light and truth and freedom. Whatever mitigations may be made in the severity of this, in the severity of this logic, whatever concessions validating life and personality for the time being, yet from this viewpoint, the true law of living must be whatever role can help us soonest to get back to self-knowledge and lead by the most direct road to nirvana. The true ideal must be an extinction of the individual and the universal, a self-annulment in the absolute. This ideal of self-extinction, which is boldly and clearly proclaimed by the Buddhist, is in Vedantic thought a self-finding. But the self-finding of the individual by his growth into his true being in the absolute would only be possible if both are interrelated realities. It could not apply to the final world abolishing self-affirmation of the absolute in an unreal or temporary individual by the annulment of the false personal being and by the destruction of all individual and cosmic existence for that individual consciousness. However much these errors may go on, helplessly inevitable, in the world of ignorance permitted by the absolute, in a universal, eternal, and indestructible avidya.
So here Sri Aurobindo takes up the supra-cosmic view of things, as he says. And he presents it, if you read between the lines, in three ways. Or rather, in two major ways, but also hinting to the third way. And Sri Aurobindo takes pains to bring this particular view to light again and again in the Life Divine, partly because there is so much weight that has been invested in this particular view, the view of the supracosmic, which has a tremendous amount of power. And the power is based on a truth. And the truth is that we are talking about the absolute. And if we are talking about the absolute, there can be no relative that has any truth against that absolute. All our experience of finite existence, relative existence, of relations, which give us our definition of reality, are somehow seen to be completely negated by this absolute. And so, a supracosmic view of reality would concentrate, focus, or give validity to the exclusive reality of the supracosmic or absolute. And of course, this is a truth, or this is the truth. The truth is, there is nothing other than the absolute. Now, this particular truth can, however, be understood in a variety of ways when we try to approach it from the viewpoint of the relative. And that is what we are doing. It's from our relative and limited and finite viewpoints that we are approaching the most infinite of infinites. So question is, how are we to approach it? And Sri Aurobindo is presenting over here two kinds of approaches to this. One is that of a self-extinction, and that is what is the nirvana of the Buddhists, as he pulls it over here, that in the face of this absolute is so incomprehensible that it is best to call it a non-being. Whatever we call being, as I said, is within the domain of experience, and therefore it is always going to fall short of this absolute. To arrive at this absolute, we can affirm it as a kind of absolute non-being that can only be known or not known, as the case may be, through an extinction of the self. So that is our approach to the supracosmic absolute from one viewpoint, and that will lead to a certain yoga, that darshan will lead to a certain yoga, an aim of life, which aim of life will be self-extinction, extinction of self-consciousness, of the power to experience. Now, the other approach that the relative may have may be one of self-finding, as he says over here. And that self-finding would imply that on one side, again, that splits into two. The most obvious relative approach to this self-finding would be a denial or an extinction of the limited self and a emergence, a certain kind of absolute a laya, as they say, a kind of a dissolution of the individual self in the absolute. A dissolution in the absolute would affirm the absolute and would take away the relative completely from the field of reality, because there is nothing but the absolute. But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out here is that, yes, to affirm that there is nothing but the absolute is true and right, but the relative may also be part of that nothing that there is, which is the absolute. In other words, the relative may be already a self formulation of the absolute, okay? The absolute in that form. So Sri Aurobindo is pointing to a third approach, or another kind of interpretation of the approach of the relative to the absolute as a self-finding, as a kind of relationship which allows the individual self to discover its own absolute reality. In other words, this absolute has become this relative. This relative is not something which needs to extinct itself, but which can reaffirm its own root in the absolute, and at the same time rediscover its own relative existence as a self-becoming of the absolute. In other words, not only is it a self-finding of the individual, but it is a self-finding of the absolute as well. In innumerable or infinite forms, it itself being infinite. So now, that is, in a sense, the approach to the supracosmic that Sri Aurobindo takes up, and in doing so, he is pointing to the traditional, affirmations of the supracosmic or the absolute through either Buddhism or through what we call Advaita, and this is the Advaita of Shankara. Okay, the Shankara's Advaita, also known as Keval Advaita Vedanta. Sri Aurobindo is giving us another kind of Advaita. This also is an Advaita, a non-dualism. And the Sanskrit formulation of that is Purna Advaita, integral non-dualism. because ultimately the absolute is the non-dual only reality that exists. And that is being affirmed by Sri Aurobindo. To those who feel that Sri Aurobindo is somehow saying that no, that also exists and other things exist, the reality is that no, Sri Aurobindo is affirming that that alone exists. Only the supracosmic exists. But whatever else we call the terrestrial and cosmic or the extra cosmic and the individual are all self-becomings of that which alone exists as the supracosmic. That is the integral Purna Advaita, the integral Advaitism of Sri Aurobindo.
Does he mean madness is equivalent of ignorance?
By madness, yes, that's a very interesting part that he brings up over here, this image of a madhouse. And there's two things, and important things, subsidiary things in this paragraph that are worth considering or bringing to our own attention. One is how he ends it, and basically these kinds of views of the relationship between the relative and absolute, which deny reality to the relative, can only do so by actually claiming that the relative is somehow a mistake, an error, not a temporary error or a partial error, an error of becoming with a certain truth within it, but a permanent error, an error which is somehow allowed to exist eternally within being. That's why you see the end of that particular paragraph is, however much these errors may go on, helplessly inevitable, in the world of ignorance permitted by the absolute, in a universal, eternal, and indestructible avidya. Okay, so that notion of a eternal, indestructible, universal avidya is a certain kind of presumption upon the relative, which Sri Aurobindo does not believe is necessary to presume. See, but that presumption is necessary to those who believe in the reality of the supracosmic to the exclusion of the reality of the relative and the individual. That is one thing to recognize. The other thing to recognize is this image of the madhouse that he brings up over here. And as Sitaram is asking, is the madhouse a kind of an adequate description of avidya, of ignorance, of the world of ignorance? And the answer is yes, the world of ignorance as a chaotic place in which, you see, a madhouse can only be called a madhouse if sanity knows what is madness. If there was no sense of sanity against which to measure madness, then there wouldn't have been even any necessity to call it a madhouse. So what we are saying is that there is a certain kind of sanity already at work in this madhouse, which allows us to feel that there is a certain kind of madness going on. The equation of madness and sanity is usually related to rationality, is related to the fact that there is a certain kind of law, order, intelligence, a certain rightness to things, a certain way in which things unfold, which have a certain kind of truth, consciousness behind them, a knowledge of the placement of things in their right place, which can only come when there is a sense of the oneness of all things and their harmony. Everything is harmoniously presented and developed. Now, if that intuition is there, then only we can talk about a madhouse when that is completely abrogated. It is because there is an intuition of that kind in the human that we can affirm the ignorance or avidya as a madhouse, as he's saying over here. But the solution to the madness of the madhouse is really already a kind of a intuition of the transformation of the madhouse into the perfect, you know, dynamic order, the harmonious order of the one existence, you know, sort of manifesting itself in its infinite parts. However, from the viewpoint of the inhabitant of the madhouse, it may feel or seem that the best solution that one can find to it is an escape from this madhouse. How can we replace it with another reality outside of it? Because this seems to be a reality that no individual can cure. That is beyond, that's why it is universal. It's beyond the scope of individual remedy. You know, there's Plato's parable of the cave is similar. It is, there is this cave of darkness in which everybody lives. But when one person goes out and sees that there's a light, he realizes that these people are living in a certain kind of total darkness. He comes back and tries to explain it, but these people think he's crazy. They stone him to death. They exile him from that condition of darkness. So he has to go out into the light, but be alone. And unknown to all these people, he remains in a different world. So to them, he is mad, so to say. So there is a certain kind of irony, because this is a universal condition. It is not a condition of one man, okay? And people may individually or in some kind of sporadic instances escape from it, but that's why when they come back, the best they can do is to claim that individually we can find escapes. We can get out of this cave of darkness and madness, but to be bold enough to say that the cave itself can be transformed into a condition of truth, of light, of unity and harmony, seems to be something beyond the scope of any individual. But Sri Aurobindo is making that claim on the basis that that is the intrinsic intuition in all of us, even in assuming that this reality is a madhouse, that there is something which can be set right.
Devil's advocate, maybe the other people are right. Sri Aurobindo will turn out to be wrong, that this is just too difficult a game, and escapes. Mute? Now mute. Okay, this is Michael asking a question. Let me put it this way. We feel that Sri Aurobindo is the brightest and correct, but could we be mistaken? It is the other game that is equally right, the escaping game. Or it could be that we may find... Could we find that this project is too difficult and change our minds some centuries later and play the escaping game in a more sophisticated way or something like that?
Okay, good question, Michael. Now, the issue of whether this is correct or incorrect is, of course, you know, I mean, the old proverb, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's a question of what do we experience? Is it possible? Ultimately, Sri Aurobindo has a place where he says, anything is possible if you prove that it's possible. So ultimately, it's a question of whether anybody can do it or not. Now, on the other hand, there is something important in this whole issue, and that also relates to the universality problem. That to recognize the universality of the condition of ignorance, avidya, is very, very important. One cannot be an ostrich and wish away the fact of avidya. You may escape from it, but the fact of avidya does not go away. Even if the bodhisattva comes, the last bodhisattva comes and allows every individual to attain to nirvana, still the fact of ignorance is not going to go away, because it remains, it will spawn new creatures to experience its universal condition of ignorance. Ignorance is beyond our human condition. See, that is its fundamental universality. Now, the point Sri Aurobindo is making is that though individually we cannot wish it away, and we can transcend it individually, it itself, as he makes the case elsewhere, cannot but be a certain formulation of the Absolute. In other words, he's, as he says somewhere else, that either the Absolute has to be considered as impotent, or it has to be considered as containing a fundamental duality within itself, which is also a condition of impotence, not really Absolute. Or it has to be considered an Absolute which has allowed this condition to exist within itself. If it has allowed this condition to exist within itself, it must be within its power to overcome this condition. If it is within its power to overcome this condition, then it must be within the power of somebody who can arrive at that power to overcome this condition. Now, since the whole assumption, whether of Sri Aurobindo or of the others, is that this fundamental Absolute is the only thing there is, and even in our self-extinction, we are attaining to union with that, then what is so difficult in assuming that it is possible for the individual to arrive at the self-power of that which alone exists? This is Sri Aurobindo's assumption here. That in our yoga, which is the counterpart, inseparable counterpart of the darshan of integrality, that we can arrive at the integral power which can change this condition, universal condition, because the universal condition is the condition of universal being, and universal being is that which has become in each individual an individualized aspect of itself. Therefore, it is possible for the individual to arrive at union not only in being, but in power with that consciousness, and effect the change that that consciousness could have effected. In that instance, in that case, there's an interesting, see in the Western sort of thinking, and even in Indian thinking, there is one school that holds, who are we to change what God has put into place? The answer is, we are God. Therefore, we have the right to have the power to change what God has put into place, because we are that the divine has become. And we can become the divine to transform the creation of the divine. And that is the stand that Sri Aurobindo takes in as much as this is concerned. That the divine has not deployed this particular power the divine can deploy, is no proof that it cannot be deployed by identity with that power. Now, the mechanics or dynamics of that identity and that deployment is another thing. It is not an ego identification, but an identification that is very well brought out in Savitri, for example, when we find Ashwapati reaching the heights of the unknowable, and there calling on the Divine Mother to incarnate, to transform, to change the iron law, as he puts it over there. So there is a will, but this the deployment of that will is through a process of double, consciousness, a consciousness of surrender and a consciousness of identification. The two coexist. in our approach to the absolute and our identification with the power of the absolute.
Devashishda, on this topic, can you talk about where Sri Aurobindo addresses the question of whether the manifestation could not have happened without this ignorance?
Any manifestation you mean, or this manifestation in which we find ourselves participating?
Yes, in I don't know if that is relevant, but if it is, yes, this manifestation.
Because certainly manifestation can be there without the ignorance. And not only can, whatever can also does exist. So there is a manifestation without the ignorance.
Oh, okay. So there is a manifestation without the ignorance, and there is also a manifestation with the ignorance, and we are participating in one of them.
Yeah, and also we may put it in a different way and say there is a manifestation without the ignorance that knows itself to be without the ignorance, and there is another manifestation without the ignorance which knows itself to be ignorant.
Oh.
That is the one we are participating in. Because ultimately all manifestation is without the ignorance in the eyes of the absolute. Who is not ignorant of it. But the veil is cast in a certain manifestation within which those who exist experience the ignorance as their condition of being and becoming. And that is what we are participating in. Now, why is this? Now, that question has been answered in many, many ways. And this is another one of those eternal events, one may say. And one of the ways in which Mother has answered this question is that this question itself is illegitimate, because what exists, exists. In other words, whatever is manifest has been manifest among the infinity of possibilities that exist and that can manifest. But there are other answers to it also that both she and Sri Aurobindo have given. And you may say that if we admit that delight is the fundamental reality of conscious being, of infinite conscious being, then all form of manifestation must be forms of delight. Then this thing that we call ignorance is a specific form of delight. And that delight is the delight of growing up. The delight of growing up, which cannot be had unless there is a veil cast. Because
beautiful.
Conscious being already is in possession of every possibility of its own existence. It cannot know its existence as a temporal increase in consciousness. Other ways of knowing, of explaining avidya also exist. One of which is to think about it as a manifestation of Maya as measure. Maya itself, Sri Aurobindo points out, means is derived from the root to measure. And this measurement of that which is immeasurable is only possible through the fragmentation of the immeasurable and the casting of the opposite of the immeasurable. In other words, of making it without measure. Immeasurability is, you may say, infinity. And if infinity is to arise into a consideration of its own value as infinite, what is the value of infinity, then it has to emerge as infinite finites. But for that emergence, you first need the appearance of the flip side of the immeasurable, of the lack of measure, that is the zero. And so that may be considered as the lapse into ignorance, the drop into nescience, into inconscience, into the absence of consciousness, into absence. Presence becomes absence, which becomes the basis of the ignorance, out of which may arise the fragmented infinity of infinite being, so as to measure its own infinity, its own immeasurable power, its own immeasurable light, consciousness, delight. So this is one way of understanding this manifestation, as you call it, and the necessity of avidya within it.
Nice. I really like the previous, the way you put it about how the delight of growing up cannot be had without casting a veil.
Yes.
Michael, I didn't mean to hijack your question, so if you have anything else to add.
I do want to ask briefly, why are the people who are bright in the other schools, why wouldn't they be impressed with the argument, you're cutting short your opportunity, you're cutting short your experience to grow, to become?
That question is one of the most difficult to answer. Perhaps, again, we have to rest on the notion of adhikarvad, of the fact that at some level things are not explainable by logic, by reason, by even an appeal to our deepest intuitions or an appeal to the best possibilities available to us. Now, Sri Aurobindo is making that appeal, no wonder. That's why all these volumes have been written by him. And yet, that appeal is not being made primarily to the mind. That appeal is being made to something deeper. And we may even say that one of the very fundamental reasons for his articulating himself in so many volumes and all the writing that he has done is to change the adhikar of the present stage of phase of ignorance. That in a sense, he is calling for a kind of a transition, a kind of a transcendence of our own possibilities of limitation. And that in some way, at some level of the human psyche, the human being is ready to recognize it. But these things don't happen overnight and they don't happen to everybody all at once. And it's going to be that there will be a faith. Ultimately, all these things are based on faith, our will, our ability, as he says, to embrace a goal of life is ultimately related to some very deep faith, and that is connected to adhikar, adhikar path. That is really the sense of that 17th chapter in the Gita on faith, where Sri Krishna says, you are what your faith is. Yo yat shraddha sa eva sa, you are what your shraddha is. So in that sense, it is impossible to, you know, sort of push anybody beyond what their secret inner aspiration, you know, moves towards. And one shouldn't, you know. One of mother's closest friends was a Buddhist, you know, Madame Alexandra David Neal. Mother never once tried to convince Madame Alexandra David Neal of the rightness of the integral yoga. She has in fact, you know, talked to others about the greatness of Madame Alexandra David Neal's own Buddhist yoga. Because that was her dharma. So swadharma and adhikar are related. That's a very important lesson to take home, because ultimately, in understanding that, you know, lies the question of tolerance in this world. The fact that everybody has a right to believe what they believe and to move towards the views or visions of truth that they follow, that they wish to follow.
Here is Ramon Dal, who's here with me. So I guess that what you're saying is Sri Aurobindo anchored the new matrix for the planet, and that some schools are still valid depending on what you call the Attica, and that's good for them,
right? Yes, in a way you could say that. But you know, even to put it like that, to some extent, sounds a little fundamentalist, or a window of fundamentalism a little bit. But the fact is that what he's pointing out over here indeed is his darshan. In other words, it's not just a speculation. He is appealing to our best intuition of these things, but he's also stating something after having arrived at the experience of it. And that is, in the best sense of the Vedantic tradition, what darshan is. Darshan makes or utilizes logic. Shankara utilized logic in ample measure, but so did Ramanuja, so did Madhava, so did Nimbarka, so did all these great philosophers. But their utilization of logic was basically after having arrived at a certain realization. So it's the realization, yoga again, yoga and darshana go together in the sense that to him who propounds a darshana, the yoga is also already a living fact. Yoga as identity, yoga as unity has already become the fact of that existence. So from that point of view, what is being affirmed has also got a certain kind of power to change adhikar, if there is an openness to that. And again, whether there is an openness to that is again a matter that is beyond, you know, it's not just a question of proselytizing or converting or doing missionary activity or anything of the sort, but it's really a question of whether an individual wants to, whether that is right for them or not. See? But indeed, you may say that Sri Aurobindo is putting a lot of effort into this kind of presentation so that the integral non-dualism, as he calls it, could become a kind of common inheritance of modern or contemporary humanity.
Debashishta?
Yes.
I have a question on the process of coming to the integrality.
So, yes, Lopa, that's a very good point. Before your question, I want to make a small point, and you know, maybe your question relates to it too, but maybe let me make this small point, because we are talking about darshan as a product of yoga and also as an originator of yoga. You see? The darshan ultimately, in terms of the philosophical tradition of darshan, is a seeing, is a coming to an experience, is a coming, is an ontology, is a being more than a seeing. Now, Sri Aurobindo is talking out of a certain being, of being what he is actually seeing and what he is giving us. Now, the thing is about that the real power behind it is an appeal to our understanding, our rationality. It is an appeal to our intuition, but it goes even beyond. It goes to an appeal to our seeing, our own experience, and our own being. And that, I want to give the example of how, through vitarka, through argumentation or debate, in the Indian tradition, these great masters who have given us darshans have established their schools. A very good example is given through the life of Sri Chaitanya, for example, who gave us one of the very profound schools of philosophy, of darshan and of yoga. you know, which is known as Achintya Bheda Bheda, you know, not unthinkable unity in difference. And in a sense, Sri Aurobindo's work also incorporates exactly that. It is a kind of, you know, a persistence of duality within an absolute unity, okay, which is the realization of the darshan. So the texts tell you that he went all over India having these debates with schools of different kinds. But what actually is the determining factor in these debates is not that he was able to convince somebody else that his logic was better than theirs, but that in the course of giving his, presenting his darshan, he gave darshan. Those who were beholden to this philosophy coming through him as argumentation suddenly beheld the Lord, beheld the Supreme Being, and surrendered to it. It's that kind of power which exists in darshan as a product of yoga. That ultimately we are also here, in a sense, with us present in these words. So I just wanted to mention that as the kind of background, in a sense, of what is the difference between this kind of, you know, argumentation, various viewpoints, points, and of course it is completely, you know, dependent on adhikar. But again, this adhikar is something which can open itself to the power of darshan. That person who receives the darshan at various levels, maybe in the mind, maybe in the vital, maybe at the psychic level, maybe totally integrally, is that person who will see what it is saying. Lupa, your question.
Yeah, actually it is yes, somewhat like you said. So I just wanted to ask you if it is necessary to pass through these different phases in one life or in several lives, like have a phase of Keval Advaita and then go to the phase of materialism and, so to say, experience everything and then be able to integralize, or even before that synthesize, make a composite, then make a synthesis, and then be able to make an integral? Or it is that there are some people who are already endowed with this capacity of integralizing, and they don't have to have an exclusive concentration and pass through phases?
Yeah, you know, it's not necessary to pass through these phases as exclusive stages. You know, many people come to the integral yoga without going through any of these phases and accept or come to the root of this particular integrality as determining the different aspects of their yoga, of their seeking, of their finding. But there is something to be said about this fragmented approach as well, because mind is that which fragments. And so we, as mind embodied beings, as beings who are conditioned by the consciousness of mind, in the most profound sense, I'm talking about not just human mind, but mind with a capital M, ultimately conditioned by the consciousness of overmind and its devolution at the lower levels, is, you know, so we being conditioned in that way, are, even if we contact something more integral, we are very likely in our experience to arrive at stages or phases in which certain exclusive things will be realized by us. This is the case with Sri Aurobindo himself. He experienced the Nirvana first, and it was an exclusive realization of Nirvana. He then experienced what he calls the active Brahman. You may call it the Shakti, the universal Shakti. You may also call it the one worker in the world. You may call it Prakriti, you know, formulating everything. But he experienced it as a separate realization along with the realization of Nirvana. He then realized the immanent divine, the Vasudeva experience, where divine person is present in every, inside everything, at the heart of all things. Now, that coexisted with the other two. The other two did not go away. The other two remained in their own separate realities. So, in a sense, when you're talking about the existence of these particular experiences or realizations, these realizations can coexist and can amplify each other. But ultimately, they lead us to a higher level, the supermind, where there is a certain kind of integrality which is fundamental. These coexist as fundamental constituents of one consciousness in supermind.
Thank you.
The third one was you're talking about the Vasudeva Darshan. Vasudeva Darshan was actually more not so much the cosmic, it was the immanent, the presence of the divine within.
Devashishta, this is Sita here.
Yes, Sita.
While summarizing this paragraph, you said Sri Aurobindo was indicating three possibilities here. What is the third possibility?
The third possibility is that, let me read that part where he's talking about the Advaitic, but he's actually hinting at a different kind of formulation of Advaita. That the absolute does not need to share its relations with the relative. That there is within the relative itself the links that cause the absolute to be known as a certain self-becoming of the relative to be known as a certain self-becoming of the absolute. So he's saying over here, let me read the three possibilities. This ideal of self-extinction. Okay, so I'm reading towards the end of that paragraph, where he's talking of first of Buddhism. This ideal of self-extinction, which is boldly and clearly proclaimed by the Buddhists, is in Vedantic thought a self-finding. Okay, so he's turning around. One is a self-extinction, the other is a self-finding. But the self-finding of the individual by his growth into his true being in the absolute would only be possible if both are interrelated realities. It could not apply to the final world-abolishing self-affirmation of the absolute in an unreal or temporary individual by the annulment of the false personal being and by the destruction of all individual and cosmic existence for that individual consciousness. Let's skip the rest of it, but here itself are the three. One is the self-extinction, second is the self-finding, and then you branch in that self-finding to one kind of self-finding where the individual grows into his true being in the absolute. Because both individual and absolute are interrelated realities, and the other branch being the final world abolition, a final world abolishing self-affirmation of the absolute in an unreal or temporary individual by the annulment of the false personal being and the destruction of all individual and cosmic existence for that individual consciousness. So first you have the Buddhist formulation of self-extinction. Then you have what Sri Aurobindo has elsewhere in many places called the true Vedanta, which is the original Vedanta, which in a sense is the integral view. And then you have the Vedanta of exclusive self-finding, which negates the cosmic and the individual.
I still didn't understand the difference between the last two. Can you please explain it once more?
Yeah, let me read again that. But the self-finding of the individual by his growth into his true being in the absolute, growth into his true being in the absolute, would only be possible if both are interrelated realities. So here in this idea of the individual finding himself in the absolute through a relationship between the individual and the absolute, which is a kind of real relationship. In other words, a relationship which affirms both absolute and individual, or only the absolute and the individual as an aspect of the absolute. Okay. That kind of a view actually does not erase the individual. Okay. Basically, what he's talking about in these lines is that a self-finding of the individual by his growth into his true being in the absolute is like what we were earlier calling Chaitanya's notion of Achintya Bheda Bheda. That is, in a way, there isn't only one, and that there are two, that both of them, both these realities coexist in the absolute. This particular, one may say, paradox or illogical logic, unthinkable logic of the supermind, it holds as real there, because this is part of the logic of infinity. While if one was to use a mental logic, one would say that these are contradictions and cannot coexist. The one cannot coexist with the two. Okay? And that is basically the other aspect of the self-finding. If the individual finds the absolute, the individual cannot retain its identity. It has to be wiped out in the absolute. That is the difference.
Debashishta,
yes.
From the little I have read about Sri Aurobindo, I see that it might be wrong, the impression that I have, is that he puts a great amount of effort to refute the Keval Advaitins, but does not put as much effort to refute the materialists.
No, I think he puts a lot of effort to refute the materialists also. Actually, that's a good point that you're making. In a sense, that is the kind of logic that he draws. I think he puts a lot of effort in both cases, but there is a subtle difference between the two. And you may say that in that subtle way, he puts more effort on the Advaitins than against the materialists. And you know, in Life Divine itself, he brings it out in those two chapters, you know, the refusal of the ascetic and the materialist denial. But he's drawing on this from a very, very, you know, sort of condensed or compressed verse in the Isha Upanishad, where basically they are talking about entering into two kinds of darknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Into a darkness they go who follow after the avidya alone for its own sake. But into a greater darkness they go who follow after the vidya alone for its own sake. Now these are the Keval Advaitins in a sense. They go to an even greater darkness according to the Isha Upanishad, and Sri Aurobindo brings out why. He brings it out, the reason is that entry into the self-absorption of the supraconscient is something out of which there is no issue. But entry into the ignorance, into the exclusivity of the materialist ignorance, is something which is conditioned by an evolution which irrevocably will take one back into consciousness. You see, so one can, in the denial of the absolute, still not escape the absolute, but in the refusal of the material, one can actually disappear into the partiality of the superconscious.
I see. And is it also, this could be also a false impression that I have, that the Orient has worked upon the absolute or the escape from the absolute, and the West has worked upon the materialistic philosophies. Is that something true?
Can you repeat that? It wasn't coming through very clearly.
Okay, so in Asia, or mostly in India, and Buddhism and various philosophies in India have focused on escaping in the absolute, whereas philosophies of the West have focused on being materialistic.
In a way, yes. Actually, you may say that Western philosophies and Indian philosophies, both these things have their historical periods of focus on these matters. And today we are at a stage, it can't be, it's not, you know, see, this is a very good, important point to understand, that in a sense, Sri Aurobindo does not essentialize East and West into these two kinds of camps. But he is saying that today the condition is such that the West historically has prioritized a material existence, just as the East has prioritized its focus on the spirit. You know, Western philosophers themselves have critiqued their own history of philosophy and of society. And this can be seen as both a lack and a strength, because in a sense, this focus on the material has ultimately brought the world to a certain point where there is the aspiration for the perfectibility of material life, of social life, of the material organization of collective life. And on the other hand, in the Eastern case, we've had a certain kind of emphasis on the freedom from all bondage to various kinds of formulations or engineering of society. So these are both the strengths and the weaknesses, but both of these are historical developments. They can't be seen as essentialism. For all time, the West was like that, or for all time, the East was like this. India has had its more, its glorious manifestations of material existence, just as the West has had its, you know, depths of spiritual life.
Yeah, and it's not even fair to just divide the world in two halves like that, because, for example, the natives of America, they had their own philosophies, and Africa, they have their own philosophy that we are not considering here. So there's so much variety.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. It's actually due to the notion of civilization, which ultimately prioritizes a certain kind of written culture which becomes universal and governs a very large number of people and makes them follow a certain kind of, you know, sort of way of social being, that these nations that we are talking about, whether we talk about, you know, the sort of further east, or we talk about India or the south, southern Asia, or we talk about the Middle East, or we talk about Europe, while we think about, you know, the Native Americans or, you know, the Africans as having had a culture, nevertheless, which also had its own kind of periods of height and its own formulation of both spiritual and material realities, but did not engage in that same way in a kind of a written dialogue with the history of the world.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, let's read the next paragraph and sort of keep it hanging for the next week.
Okay. Jyoti, would you like to read?
No, because I still can't get it. Sorry.
Can somebody from India read? Then we would know how the connection is.
How about Punita? Punita, can you read?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. We Hello? Can. Yes, we can hear you very well. Nice.
Okay, I'll read. But this idea of the total vanity of life is not altogether an inevitable consequence of the supracosmic theory of existence. In the Vedanta of the Upanishads, the becoming of the Brahman is accepted as a reality. There is no room, therefore, for a truth of the becoming. There is in that truth a right law of life, a permissible satisfaction of the hedonistic element in our being, its delight of temporal existence, an effective utilization of its practical energy, of the executive force of consciousness in it. But the truth and the law of its temporal becoming once fulfilled, the soul has to turn back to its final self-realization, for its natural highest fulfillment is a release, a liberation into its original being, its eternal self, its timeless reality. There is a circle of becoming starting from, just one moment, I'll have to interrupt, I'm sorry, my baby's crying. Hello?
Yes, not a problem, Punita. Would you rather just, somebody else read?
Yes, yes, please somebody else continue, I'm sorry for the disturbance.
No problem. How about somebody, anybody else from India?
Okay, I'm fine. I can read now. The soul has to turn back to its final realization, for its natural highest fulfillment is a release, a liberation into its original being, its eternal self, its timeless reality. There is a circle of becoming starting from eternal being and ending in it, or from the point of view of the Supreme as a personal or super-personal reality, there is a temporary play, a game of becoming and living in the universe. Here, evidently, there is no other significance of life than the will of the being to become, the will of consciousness and the urge of its force towards becoming, its delight of becoming for the individual. When that is withdrawn from him or fulfilled in him and no longer active, the becoming ceases. But otherwise, the universe persists or always comes back into manifestation, because the will to become is eternal and must be so, since it is the inherent will of an eternal existence. It may be said that one defect in this view of things is the absence of any fundamental reality of the individual, of any abiding value and significance of his natural or his spiritual activity. But it can be replied that this demand for a permanent personal significance, for a personal eternity, is an error of our ignorant surface consciousness. The individual is a temporary becoming of the being, and that is a quite sufficient value and significance. It may be added that in a pure or in an absolute existence, there can be no values and significances. In the universe, values exist and are indispensable, but only as relative and temporary buildings. There can be no absolute values, no eternal and self-existent significances in a time structure. This sounds conclusive enough, and it seems that nothing more can be said about the matter. And yet, the question remains over, for the stress on our individual being, the demand on it, the value put on individual perfection and salvation is too great to be dismissed as a device for a minor operation, the coiling and uncoiling of an insignificant spiral amid the vast circlings of the eternal's becoming in the universe. Should I end here?
Yes.
Devishishta, can you give a gist of this paragraph for us to contemplate?
Yeah, I think the only thing one can say over here is that he is looking at one, again, when we were talking about the different views of the supracosmic, sort of reality, then he took up two branches of the Vedantic, approach of self-finding. The more positive one, also he is differentiating over here, interestingly. And as Sri Aurobindo has said, the Vedanta itself, the original Vedanta, not the interpretations of the Vedanta, itself has got a certain kind of historical development to it. That with time we find that there is a greater and greater stress on escape, on the affirmation of the absolute, without giving totally no value to without giving no value to the becoming. Yet that the primacy is given to the being. Becoming is seen as an act of delight of the being, and therefore being can be experienced as becoming. Therefore, so long as we are in the becoming, we are talking about a universal and cosmic power of becoming. Individual has no real place in it, but this cosmic power of becoming, universal and cosmic power of becoming, as an aspect of the delight of being, is something that the individual can experience. Therefore, there is no need, one is say, of getting extinct or in a pure supracosmic being. One can enjoy it even here through a kind of, one may say, Jivan Mukti. However, even in this formulation, there isn't sufficient grounds given for the fundamental truth of the individual. We were talking about a cosmic becoming as being true, but there is no reason for it to become. In other words, it is a kind of a random act of delight. Becoming is a kind of a, it has also no temporal some bounds to it. In other words, it always existed and it will always exist. There will be being and there will be becoming. Becoming will come and go in its coilings and uncoilings, as he says. In other words, Swamiji is talking about the kalpas, the fact that, just like we may think about the materialist sense of the expansions and contractions of an universe, we may think in the Vedantic sense of the expansions and contractions of a consciousness. When it contracts and disappears, becomes latent, then there is only the stillness of being. But that does not mean that becoming did not exist. It just has gone into latency. It re-arises as a certain kind of new manifestation. But all these are cosmic realities, realities of delight, and the individual can experience it both outside of the manifestation and within the manifestation. However, the problem with this whole thing is that neither any meaning is there to the becoming, nor any real meaning given to the individual. This is, in a nutshell, what he's
pointing to over here.
Shall we conclude with the meditation?
Yes. And I think this wonderful last paragraph, we'll resume it next week. I must say, to all of you, it's been a wonderful experience, this continuing experience of study on Skype. And next week will be, for some time, my last week in Los Angeles. And after that, I'm joining my friends like Punita and others in India in resuming the study from that part of the world. So hopefully seamlessly nobody will know that anything has changed, but I'll be resuming from India a week after next.
And if there's need be any change, will there be any changes to timings?
Hopefully not. We'll just continue the same times using the timing over there.
How many classes do you know approximately from India?
About seven, I think. Six or seven, I think.
Thank you.